properly asked her. She told Will, "Fight or fuck."
"What?"
"Those are your choices," she said. "You can either fight with me or you can fuck me."
"Sarah."
She walked over to him because she always had to do everything. She put her hands on his shoulders, looked him in the eye. "We can either talk about all the things that we're not talking about, or we can go to the bedroom." His jaw tightened, but he looked persuadable. "Will." Sarah brushed back his hair. His skin was hot. She could smell the light scent of his aftershave, which meant that even though he was mad at her, he had still shaved for her because he knew that Sarah preferred his face to be smooth. She kissed him lightly on the lips. When he didn't resist, she kissed him again, this time making it clear that there were other things she could do with her mouth. Will seemed game, until he wasn't. He broke away. He stared down at her. She could see all of the things that they were both afraid to talk about bubbling to the surface. Sarah would not survive another argument. She kissed him again. Her hand slipped inside his shirt. She let her fingers trail along the ripple of muscles. She whispered in his ear, "Come 69 with me." His breath caught. His heartbeat doubled. She felt his response pressing against her leg.
"Sarah."
His voice was thick in his throat.
"Should we?"
Her lips brushed his ear. She kissed his neck, started to unbutton her shirt. She could still feel his reluctance, even as she cupped his hand on her breast. Her mouth went back to his ear. Instead of kissing it, she clenched his earlobe between her teeth. Will's breath caught again. She told him, "Let's get a little rough." This time when she kissed him, he kissed back harder. He grabbed her by the waist. He backed her into the cabinet. Her body crushed against his. His hand squeezed her breast. She felt the blissful release of her senses flooding with desire. But then, Will stepped away. He held her at arm's length.
"I'm sorry, this is my limit."
She shook her head. What?
"You've hit my limit, Sarah. This is it."
"What are you?" She said the words to his back because he was walking away from her. "Will!" The door closed behind him. Sarah looked around the kitchen, trying to replay in her head what had just happened. What limit? What did "this is it" mean? She tried to button her shirt. Her fingers were clumsy. Will was screwing with her, playing some kind of game. He was probably waiting on the other side of the door, expecting her to chase after him. They had danced to the song once before, back when Sarah had reached her own limit. She had been livid with Will for hiding things, lying to her face. She had told him to leave, and he had left. But when she'd opened the door, he was sitting in the hallway waiting for her. He had said, "I don't have a lot of quit in me." Sarah rubbed her face with her hands. She wasn't about to quit Will either. She couldn't be untethered right now. She would have to fix this no matter what. If that meant apologizing to a sulking grown man, then she was going to apologize to a sulking grown man. Sarah walked to the door. She threw it open. The hallway was empty. Grant County, Wednesday, Chapter 12. Jeffrey sat across from Kaylee Pierce, inside the dorm she shared with Rebecca Catarino. He didn't have time to kick himself for not listening to his instincts. The Catarino case had gone from a DOA to an accident to an attempted murder and possible sexual assault within the span of 24 hours. What he needed now were facts. Everything they had done so far had been going through the motions. Now he knew the hard truth. Catarino had been targeted by her attacker. You didn't just walk around with a hammer unless you had plans to use it. The girl had either been followed off campus or followed into the woods by someone who intended to commit an act of violence. And now, Leslie Truong, the witness that his own damn team had let walk away, was missing, possibly abducted. The only path open to Jeffrey was to start over from the beginning.
I don't know what I can say.
Kaylee had a habit of letting her voice go up at the end of every other sentence, as if she was asking a question instead of answering one. He said,
I know you already talked to one of my officers. Just take me through the events of yesterday morning. Anything you can remember would be helpful.
She picked at a piece of loose skin on the sole of her foot. The girl was wearing blue silk pajamas. Chinese characters were tattooed on the inside of her wrist. Her short blonde hair had worked its way into a spiral while she'd slept.
Like I said, I was asleep.
Jeffrey looked down at his notebook. He silently debated whether or not to tell Kaylee that her friend had been attacked. He went with his gut, which was telling him that the second she found out, her usefulness as a witness would take a nosedive. The girl tended to turn everything back around on herself, which wasn't unexpected. She was still at that age where you could only see the world through your own lens. He told Kaylee,
Go on.
Bex was really mad at us, all of us. She just started screaming like a crazy person, knocking stuff over, throwing things.
The kitchen was a mess, but Jeffrey could tell the garbage can had been kicked. The plastic was dented. The trash on the floor had created a slime trail. The only item that seemed to have been spared was a tan leather backpack beside the fridge. He asked,
Why was Becky mad?
Who knows?
Kaylee shrugged, but Jeffrey could guess that she not only knew what her friend had been angry about, but with whom she was angry.
She kicked open my door, and she yells, You bitches, like she hates us. Then I follow her to her bedroom to see what her deal is, only she won't tell me.
Becky's room is at the end of the hall?
Yes.
She finally managed a phrase of proper answer.
When we first got here, everybody saw the room was the smallest and we were all bracing for a fight or something, but Bex goes, I'll take the small one, and like that, we were all best friends.
Was she seeing anyone?
She broke up with her girlfriend over the summer, but there's been nobody since then. Not even a date. There's a lot of assholes on campus.
Was anyone fixated on her?
No way. Bex didn't even go to bars or have fun or anything.
She shook her head hard enough to make her hair fly.
If someone was, like, fixated, I would have gone straight to the cops. The for reals cops, not the mall cops on campus.
Jeffrey was glad she knew there was a difference.
Did Becky ever tell you she felt unsafe? Or like someone was watching her?
Oh my God, was someone watching her?
She looked at the kitchen, the door, the hallway.
Should I be worried? Am I, like, in danger?
These are routine questions. It's the same thing I would ask in any other interview.
Jeffrey watched the anxiety tease in and out of her features. Within an hour, every woman on campus would probably be asking if she should be worried.
Kaylee, let's concentrate on yesterday morning. Did Becky say anything to you when you followed her back to her bedroom?
She was, like, putting on her running clothes. Which, okay, she likes to run, but it was super early. And then Vanessa goes, Don't go out at rape o'clock, which was funny at the time, only now we're all just so worried because she's in the hospital. And her dad, Gerald, called this morning and he was crying, which is hard because I've never heard my own dad cry. So hearing him cry made me really sad.
Kaylee rubbed her fingers into her eyes, but there were no tears.
I had to tell my teachers I need to skip classes for the rest of the week. It's just so random. Beck's going for a run, then she hits her head and her life is, I don't know. But it's so sad. I can barely get out of bed because what if it had been me? I like to run, too.
Jeffrey paged back through his notebook.
Denisha told me that Becky spent the previous night at the library.
She did that a lot. She was, like, terrified of losing her scholarship.
Kaylee took a handful of tissues from the box on the table.
I mean, she talked about money a lot. A lot? Like, not the way you talk about money, because you just don't?
Jeffrey was familiar with the paradigm. Growing up in Sylacauga, he had known that he was poor, but he hadn't realized until his first day at Auburn what the opposite of poor really looked like. He asked,
"Is that her backpack?"
Kaylee looked over the kitchen.
"Yeah?"
Jeffrey returned his notebook to his pocket. He walked into the kitchen. He had to step over empty yogurt cartons and popcorn bags. The backpack was good leather, with the initials BC monogrammed onto the flap. He assumed it was a graduation gift, because it wasn't the kind of thing a poor college kid would spend money on. Jeffrey carefully laid out the contents on the small square of available counter space. Pens, pencils, papers, printouts, work assignments. The flip phone was an older model. He opened it. The battery was almost dead. There were no missed calls. The recent calls were cleared. He checked the contacts. Dad, Daryl, Denisha. He asked Kaylee,
"Who's Daryl?"
"He lives off campus," she shrugged. "Everybody knows him. He used to go here, but he dropped out 2 years ago because he's, like, trying to be a professional skateboarder."
"Does he have a last name?"
"Like, I'm sure he does, but I don't know."
Jeffrey recorded Daryl's number in his spiral-bound notebook. The phone would be logged into evidence, something Lena had failed to do yesterday when she talked to Rebecca Caterino's doormates. He reached into the backpack again. He found a textbook on organic chemistry, another on textiles, a third on ethics and science. The laptop computer was a newer model, judging by the weight. He opened the clamshell. The document on screen was entitled rcaterino-chem-final.doc. He paged through the exam, which was just as tedious and pedantic as every paper he had written in college. He looked up at Kaylee. She was still picking at the skin on her foot. He asked her,
"Can you come over here and tell me if there's anything missing?"
She heaved herself up from the couch. She flounced over. She looked at the textbooks and papers and she told him,
"I guess no. But her banana clip would be by the bed."
"Banana clip?"
"It's like for your hair."
Jeffrey felt his gut instinct send up a flare. Leslie Truong had been missing a headband. Now Becky Caterino was missing a hair clip. He didn't want to lean Kaylee. He asked,
"Is it still by the bed?"
"No, because that's the point."
She seemed confused.
"Becky couldn't find it? And then we all looked and we couldn't find it? I told the lady cop this."
There was only one lady cop on the force.
"Officer Adams?"
"Yeah, I told her that Becky's banana clip, the one her mom gave her, wasn't on the nightstand where she always left it. And at first Becky was mad at me, but then she knew I didn't take it because I wouldn't take something that was special like that, because she had already told me the story about her mom gave it to her, like it was the very last thing she gave to her, only it was to borrow, but then her mom died, so she had to keep it forever."
Jeffrey tried to parse the run-on sentence.
"You told Officer Adams that Becky was missing her banana clip."
"Right."
Now it was Jeffrey's turn to do the irritating question thing.
"The clip belonged to her mother?"
"Right."
"And Becky always kept the clip on her nightstand?"
"Right."
"But the morning she looked for it, the clip wasn't there?"
"Yes."
"Show me."
She took him down the hallway. He ignored the pungent odor of pot and sweat and sex that permeated the rooms. No beds were made. Clothes were strewn across the floor. He saw bongs and underwear and used condoms dropped beside trash cans.
"Here."
Kaylee had stopped just outside the bedroom at the end of the hall.
"We already, like, looked to take it to her at the hospital, but we couldn't find it."
Jeffrey took in the room. Becky wasn't tidy, but she wasn't on the same level of a disorder as her doormates. He saw the nightstand, water glass, lamp. Book of poetry pressed open so that the spine was cracked. Jeffrey resisted the temptation to close the book. He got down on his hands and knees. There was nothing under the nightstand. He looked under the bed. One sock, a bra, fuzz, and the expected detritus. He asked Kaylee,
"Does Becky know Leslie Truong?"
"The missing girl?" She frowned. "I don't think so. Because she's like older? Like about to graduate?"
"Would they have run into each other in the library?"
"Maybe. But it's a big library."
Jeffrey's cell phone rang. He suppressed a curse when he saw the number. His mother had called him 3 times already. She was probably nursing her 4th drink of the day and mourning the fact that her only son was an uncaring jerk. He silenced the call.
"Chief?" Lena was in the hallway. "I re-canvassed the dorm. No one remembered anything new."
He stood up from the floor. Fuzz covered the bottom half of his pants. He tried to wipe it away.
"We're needed back to the station."
Lena stepped aside so he could pass. Jeffrey had already given Kaylee his business card. He imagined the girl would avail herself of the number when she found out that her dorm mate had been the victim of more than an accident. He assumed word was already spreading around campus. Sybil Adams was right about the school thriving on gossip. Maybe someone would say the wrong thing to the right person, because the way it was looking now, that was the only way he was going to break either of these cases. Jeffrey looked for Brad in the main hallway. He had been assigned to canvassing the dorm for a second time. Jeffrey caught him coming out of one of the rooms.
"Katerino's backpack is in the kitchen. Log everything into evidence."
"Yes, Chief."
Jeffrey retrieved his notebook. He dialed the number for Daryl. The phone rang once, then he heard an operator tell him that the line was no longer in service. He looked at the phone as if it could offer an explanation. He double-checked the number. He tried it again. The same message came back. The line had been disconnected. Lena asked,
"What is it, Chief?"
Jeffrey bypassed the elevator and took the stairs. There could be a lot of reasons that Daryl's phone number was no longer in service. Most of the students were barely scraping by. Burner phones were not uncommon. Neither was running out of money to buy more minutes. Still, the timing bothered him. Outside, Lena double-stepped beside him to keep up as they walked across the quad. She asked,
"Isn't your car the other way?"
"Yes."
Jeffrey kept his stride long, so she had to work for it.
"Did you search Becky Caterino's book bag?"
"I was..."
Lena's face told the story.
"She had an accident. At least that's what we thought, so..."
"I stood in that field 24 hours ago and told you that we always treat accidents like potential homicides. Didn't I tell you that?"
Jeffrey wasn't in the mood for one of her excuses.
"What about the hair clip?"
"The..."
"You didn't think the missing hair clip was something that should be brought to my attention?"
"I..."
"It's not in your official report, Lena. Is it in your notebook?"
She scrambled to unbutton her shirt pocket.
"Don't put it in there after the fact. It'll look suspicious."
"Suspicious, too."
"We're gonna get hit with a massive lawsuit over this. You realize that?"
He kept his voice low as he walked past a group of students.
"Rebecca Caterino laid there for half an hour while we stood around with our thumbs up our asses. Can you put your hand on a Bible in front of a judge and honestly swear that you did everything you could from the moment you found her?"
Lena was smart enough to not try to answer.
"That's what I thought."
Jeffrey yanked open the door to the security office. Chuck Gaines had his size 12s propped on the desk. He was eating an apple and watching an episode of The Office. Jeffrey had never seen the man leave his desk during working hours, except to go to the toilet or the lunch counter. He didn't even have the courtesy to stand when Jeffrey entered the building.
"Daryl,"
Jeffrey said, giving the name from Rebecca Caterino's phone.
"He used to be a student. I need his last name."
Chuck pushed a bite of apple into his cheek.
Gonna need more than that, Chief. Skateboarder, mid-20s, dropped out 2 years ago.
You know how many...
Jeffrey kicked his feet off the desk. He slapped away the apple. He shoved the chair back against the wall. Then he got into Chuck's face.
Answer my goddamn question.
Jesus Christ!
Chuck had his hands up in surrender.
Daryl?
Jeffrey took a step back.
Skateboarder. He dropped out 2 years ago. Everyone on campus supposedly knows him.
I don't know a Daryl, but...
Chuck duck-walked his chair over to his desk. He found a stack of note cards in a drawer.
Might be something in here.
Jeffrey had a similar collection of field interview cards back at the station. Every cop had their own stack of FIs, an informal record of the names and details of suspicious characters who hadn't yet earned an official police file.
All right, let's see.
Chuck removed the rubber band from the campus FIs. None of them were written in his own hand. He left that work to the guards underneath him, who actually patrolled the campus. He shuffled through the cards until he found what he was looking for.
Here it is. There's an asswipe who's always skateboarding near the library. Tears up the metal railings on the stairs. Older kid, maybe late 20s. Floppy brown hair. I fucks all the girls, the younger the better, but who can blame them? There's not a name. According to this, everybody calls him Little Bit. He's a small-time weed dealer. None of the hard stuff.
Rebecca Caterino was a college student. Jeffrey had not been surprised to smell pot in her dorm. If Daryl was her dealer, that would explain why the burner phone number had been disconnected. Dealers were always changing up their numbers. Jeffrey took the FI card from Chuck. Little Bit. Skateboarder. Late 20s. Pot dealer. The information reflected everything he'd just been told. Chuck rolled his chair across the room to retrieve his apple from the corner. He bit it between his teeth so he could use both hands to pull his way back to his desk.
That all you need, Chief?
Jeffrey tried another name.
Thomasina Humphrey.
Chuck's face showed recognition.
Her?
Yeah, her. What do you know?
Chuck looked at Lena for the first time. Then he looked away.
Just scuttlebutt, mostly. She disappeared. Kids talk the usual crazy shit. She joined a cult. She tried to kill herself. Who knows what really happened?
Jeffrey would have bet that Chuck knew, but he had already humiliated this man once today. There would be other cases they had to work on together. He had to leave Chuck with some dignity.
Do you have access to Humphrey's details?
Maybe.
Chuck tapped some keys on his computer. He found a clean note card. He wrote down an address and phone number.
This is where her final transcripts were sent. I don't know if she's still there.
Jeffrey saw that the address was in Avondale, which lined up with what Sarah had told him. Tommy had been one of her patients at the clinic. That was why Sybil Adams had called her for help. Chuck had the apple back in his mouth.
Next time, just say please.
Jeffrey tucked the address in his coat pocket as he walked out the door. He could feel Lena dogging his heels like a needy puppy. Chief? She tried. He stopped so abruptly that she bumped into him.
Have you gone through those unsolved rape reports like I told you?
I filed the request with the other counties. They should be emailed to me no later than this afternoon. There are only 12 Grant County reports.
Only,
he repeated.
Those are 12 women, Lena. 12 lives that were irrevocably altered. I don't want to ever hear you say only about them ever again.
Yes, sir.
We live in a goddamn college town. There are thousands of young women in and out of this campus every year. Do you genuinely think that all of them are liars? That they fucked some guy and regretted it, so there's no need for you as a police officer to help them?
Chief, I...
Follow up on that subpoena I put in for Rebecca Catarino's medical charts. We need to make this official. Let me know the minute Benita Truong reaches the station. I want to talk to her as soon as possible. She is not to hear about Rebecca Catarino from anyone else but me.
Yes, Chief, but... Lena mauled the butt. When are we going to tell people that it wasn't an accident?
When I'm damn good and ready. Take out your notebook. Make a list.
She fumbled at her pocket. He didn't wait for her.
Go back to Catarino's dorm mates and see if there are any photographs of her wearing the hair clip. Do the same with Leslie Truong. She was missing a headband. They might have a photograph. Next, track down this Daryl Littlebit or whatever the hell his name is. We've got probable cause on the pot, so search him. If you find weed, arrest him. If you don't, take him in for questioning. And you don't go home tonight until you've summarized every single rape report from the Tri-County area. I want it on my desk first thing. Understood?
Yes, Chief.
Jeffrey headed toward his car in the staff parking lot. His phone started to ring again. His mother. She would be well into the bottle by now. Jeffrey silenced the call. He got into the car. He bumped the gear into reverse and swung out of the space. He tried to game out next steps as he drove toward Avondale. He would have to formally announce that Rebecca Catarino had been attacked. That would send shockwaves through the school. And it should. Some lunatic had attacked a defenseless woman with a hammer.
Christ,
he whispered. If he thought about it hard enough, he could still remember the horror of Catarino's sternum breaking. Jeffrey couldn't imagine what it took to lodge a hammer inside another human being's skull. He shook out his hands, ridding himself of the sensation. Leslie Truong's mother would be at the station in a few hours. She would have questions that Jeffrey wanted to honestly try to answer. This Littlebit skateboard punk would have to be dealt with, too. If the kid was dealing pot around campus, and he was, in fact, the same Daryl from Rebecca Catarino's phone book, then she was likely a client. Eliminating or confirming him as a suspect in the attack was a high priority. Lastly, there was Lena Adams. Jeffrey would have to go back through every single piece of information she had collected and verify the work. As far as he was concerned, her training wheels were officially off. If Lena didn't show him in real time that she could keep to the straight and narrow, he was going to send her packing. His phone started to ring. His mother again. She was clearly on one of her benders. He couldn't blame her. He was a shitty son. Hell, he had been a shitty chief, a shitty mentor, a shitty husband. Jeffrey let himself stew on his missteps until he passed a sign welcoming him to the Avondale city limits, population 4,308. Jeffrey referenced the address Chuck had given him. He should have run the information through his own system to make sure that the Humphreys still lived at the same location, but he needn't have bothered. Jeffrey could tell from the car parked in front of the house that the girl was still there. Sarah's silver Z4 was in front of the mailbox. The convertible top was down to take advantage of the good weather.
For fuck's sakes.
Jeffrey parked behind the $80,000 sports car. He took a few seconds to swallow down his irritation.
If Sarah wanted to ride around with the top down, Dolly Parton blaring from the speakers like some sad version of a tricked-out hillbilly nerd, then Godspeed.
He opened his notebook. He jotted down the list of action items from the ride over. He wasn't as careful a note-taker as he should have been. He was always riding Lena and Brad about making sure their asses were covered. Jeffrey hated to be thinking about it this way. But if Gerald Catarino really was going to sue the force, he needed to make sure his ass was covered too. He closed his notebook and pocketed his pen. He got out of the car. He looked up at the house. Avondale had at one time been filled with blue-collar workers from the railroad maintenance hub. The job had put them solidly in the middle class, and the architecture of the homes reflected that. Brick on all four sides, aluminum-framed windows, concrete driveways, all the modern conveniences of 1975. The Humphreys hadn't made any changes to the outside of the house. The white paint had yellowed, but it wasn't peeling. The car in the driveway was an older model minivan. The front door was a high-gloss black. Jeffrey knocked once, but the door was already opening. The woman who answered looked drawn. She was only slightly older than Jeffrey, but her hair had gone completely gray. The curls were clipped tight to her head. Dark circles rimmed her eyes. She was wearing a house dress that zipped in the front. The way she looked at Jeffrey made him feel guilty for being here. He assumed Sarah would make him feel worse.
Mrs. Humphrey?
She looked into the driveway, then the street.
Did you see a blue Ford truck?
No, ma'am.
If my husband comes, you'll have to leave. He doesn't want Tommy bothered with this. Do you understand?
Yes, ma'am.
She opened the door wide enough for him to pass.
They're in the backyard. Please, be quick.
Jeffrey walked into what he was expecting, a rectangle chopped up into small rooms with a bowling alley hallway down the middle. He glanced at the photographs hanging on the walls. He assumed that Tommy Humphrey was an only child. The picture showed a happy young woman, usually surrounded by a group of friends. She had played flute in the marching band. She had competed in several science fairs. She had a series of dogs, then a cat, then a boyfriend, who had taken her to the prom. The last photo was of Tommy holding a moving box outside what was obviously one of the dorm rooms at Grant Tech. There were no more pictures after that. Jeffrey pushed open a sliding glass door. He could see Sarah sitting at a picnic table with a painfully thin young woman. Bright white skin. Her hair was short and black now. Tommy Humphrey must have been in her early 20s, but she looked somehow older and younger at the same time. She was smoking a cigarette. Even from several yards, he could see the tremble in her hand. Sarah did not look surprised to see him. She told the girl, "This is Jeffrey." Tommy turned slightly, but did not look at him. Jeffrey took his cue from Sarah. She indicated the other side of the table. He sat back on the bench. He kept his hands in his lap. He had interviewed many rape victims in his law enforcement career. The first thing he'd learned was that they never acted a particular way. Some were angry. Some entered into a fugue state. Some wanted revenge. Most desperately wanted to leave. A few had even laughed when they told their stories. He had noted the same unpredictable effects among veterans returning from war. Trauma was trauma. Every person reacted differently. Sarah spoke to Jeffrey, but she looked at Tommy. "Sweetheart, what you just told me is so important. Can you tell Jeffrey?" Jeffrey gripped his hands under the table. His only option was to sit still and be quiet. Sarah said, "If it's easier, I can tell him. You've already given me permission. We want to do whatever's easiest for you." Tommy tapped her cigarette on the side of an overflowing ashtray. Her breath had the audible rasp of a chain smoker. Jeffrey thought about all of the photographs lining the hallway. Sarah was right to compare what had happened to an atomic blast. Before the assault, Tommy had been ebullient, popular, happy. Now, she was a dark shadow of her former self. Sarah said, "We could leave right now if that's what you want. But it would be helpful if Jeffrey could hear it in your own words. I promise you on my life that nothing will happen. This isn't official. You're not making a statement. No one will even know about this conversation. Right?" She had asked Jeffrey this question. He struggled to answer, not because he didn't agree, but because he felt like saying the wrong thing at this moment could break this poor woman all over again. All he could risk telling her was,
"Right."
Tommy's chest rose as she inhaled deeply on the cigarette. She held the smoke in her lungs. She finally looked up. Her eyes still did not meet Jeffrey's. Her gaze fell somewhere behind him. Smoke plumed out of her mouth.
"I was a junior."
Her tone was monosyllabic. There was something final about the way she spoke about herself in the past tense.
"I was walking back from the campus gym. I don't know what time it was. It was dark."
She put the cigarette to her lips. He could see her fingers were stained from nicotine.
"I heard someone behind me. He was swinging something at my head. I didn't see what it was. It was hard. I was stunned. He grabbed me. He dragged me into his van. He tried to get me to drink something."
Jeffrey found himself leaning forward, ears straining to hear.
"I choked on it, coughed it up."
She put her hand to her neck.
"It was in a bottle, the liquid."
Jeffrey watched tears roll down her face. He started to reach for his handkerchief, but Sarah pulled a tissue from her sleeve. Tommy didn't wipe her eyes. She clenched the tissue in her fist. She said,
"It was Gatorade or another sports drink. The blue flavor, it made my neck sticky."
Jeffrey saw the quiver in her fingers as she touched her neck to show him where.
"He was mad that I spit it out. He hit me on the back of the head. He told me not to fight back. I didn't fight back."
She shook a cigarette out of the pack and tried to light a new one off the old. Her shaking hands were barely able to make the connection. She placed the smoldering cigarette between her lips. She said,
"Then we were in the woods. I woke up in the woods. I guess I swallowed some of the Gatorade. It knocked me out. Then I came to. He was sitting there, waiting. Then he saw that I was awake. He covered my mouth with his hand, but I wasn't screaming."
She inhaled again on the cigarette. She let the smoke sit in her lungs, puffing out with each new word.
"He told me not to move. That I couldn't move. That he wanted me to act like I was paralyzed."
Jeffrey felt his lips part. He tasted the sharp burn of nicotine in the air.
"He had this thing, like a knitting needle, at the back of my neck. He said he would paralyze me forever if I didn't comply."
Jeffrey's eyes found Sarah's. He couldn't read her expression. It was like she was trying to make herself disappear.
"I didn't move. I let my arms fall to my sides. I forced my legs to stay straight. He wanted me to keep my eyes open. I kept my eyes open. He didn't want me to look at him. I didn't look at him. It was dark. I couldn't see anything. I could only feel ripping, tearing."
The cigarette dangled between her lips. Smoke curled into her face.
"Then he finished. Then he cleaned me down there. It burned. I was cut, bleeding. He wiped my face, my hands. I didn't say anything. I didn't move. I kept pretending. He dressed me. He buttoned my shirt. He pulled up my underwear. He zipped up my jeans. He told me if I told anybody else, he would do it to someone else. If I kept quiet, he wouldn't.
Sarah bent her head. Her eyes were closed.
I tried not to look at him,
Tommy said.
I thought if I couldn't identify him, he would let me go. And he did. He left me in the woods, on my back. I stayed there. He told me to act paralyzed. I was still paralyzed. I couldn't move. I don't know if I was breathing. I thought I was dead. I wanted to be dead. That's it. That's what happened.
Jeffrey was still looking at Sarah. He had questions to ask, but he didn't know how. Sarah took a breath. She opened her eyes. She asked, Tommy, do you remember what color the van was, or anything about it?
No,
she said. Then,
it was dark. The van was dark.
Sarah asked, how about the general location where you were left in the woods?
No.
She tapped ash off the cigarette.
I don't remember getting up. I don't remember walking back to campus. I must have taken a shower. I must have changed my clothes. The only memory I have after is thinking I had started my period and being happy because...
She didn't have to explain why she had been happy about getting her period. Sarah took a shallow breath.
Do you remember what he cleaned you with? A washcloth? It smelled like bleach. My hair was...
She looked down at the cigarette.
Down there, my hair was bleached.
Did he take the washcloth with him?
He took everything.
Sarah looked at Jeffrey. If there was anything else he wanted, now was the only time he was going to be able to get it. Tommy, Jeffrey has just a few more questions, okay? Just a few. Jeffrey received the order loud and clear. He worked to keep his tone soft.
Before this happened, did you feel like you were being watched?
She rolled the cigarette in the ashtray.
It's hard to think about my other self. To think about the before. I don't know that person anymore. I don't remember who she was.
I understand.
Jeffrey looked at the back of the house. He could see Tommy's mother standing at the kitchen sink. She was watching them carefully, every muscle in her face tensed.
Do you remember if anything was missing? A personal item, or...
She looked him in the eye, startled.
Can you?
The back door banged open. A large man in work coveralls filled the doorway. He had a wrench gripped in his hand. Jeffrey was standing, hand on his gun, before the man could get a word out.
What the fuck are you doing?
The man demanded.
Get the fuck away from my daughter!
Jeffrey tried.
Mr. Humphrey?
Sarah grabbed Jeffrey's hand. The contact was enough to break him out of the moment.
Who are you?
Humphrey walked down the steps.
Why are you bothering her?
I'm a police officer,
Jeffrey said.
We don't need no fucking cops!
Humphrey swung the wrench as he crossed the yard.
This is a private matter! You can't make her talk to you!
Jeffrey looked back at Tommy. She was trying to light another cigarette, acting as if nothing was happening around her.
Get out of here, asshole!
Humphrey kept coming toward them. Jeffrey longed for him to swing the wrench. This man had clearly terrorized his family. His wife was afraid of him. His daughter was already broken. Jeff? Sarah's hand tightened around his, Let's go. He reluctantly let her steer him around the side of the house. By the time they reached the front yard, Jeffrey was calculating how he could go back. Stop. She jerked his hand like she was healing a dog on a leash. You're not making it better. You're making it worse.
That man
is heartbroken. He's trying to protect his daughter. He's doing it in the wrong way, but he doesn't know what else to do. Jeffrey watched Tommy's mother close the curtains on the front window. The woman was sobbing.
Stop.
Sarah let her hand slip out from his. Beating up that girl's father will help you, but it won't do a damn thing to help her. Jeffrey leaned against his palms on the roof of his car. He felt so fucking useless. He wanted to find the monster who had destroyed that girl and break him like a stick over his knee. Sarah crossed her arms. She waited. He said,
Did you know that? What she said about the rapist holding the knitting needle to the back of her neck?
Not when it happened. She told me just now before you got here.
You never asked her for details when you were treating her? When I could do something about it?
No, Sarah said. She didn't want to talk about it.
This was 5 months ago, right? After our divorce was finalized? Were you trying to punish me? Is that what this is all about?
Get in the car. I'm not doing this in the street. Jeffrey got into his car. Sarah slammed her door so hard that the chassis shook. She asked, Do you honestly believe I would hold back something like this out of spite? Jeffrey looked back at the house.
You should have made her file a report, Sarah.
I wasn't going to force a woman who had just been brutally raped to do anything except exactly what she needed to do to feel safe. Sarah leaned up, blocking his view of the house. Except for going to medical appointments, Tommy hasn't walked more than 10 yards into the backyard since it happened. She can't sleep at night. She cries if her father is late getting home from work. She's triggered by sounds, smells, anything from the sight of the mailman to the neighbor she's known for 20 years. What happened to her in the woods is Tommy's story to tell. She has a right to not speak about it.
That's working really well for her. She's practically catatonic.
That's her choice. Do you want to take away her choice? Sarah added. And what cop at your station right now can you name who would handle her report the way it should be handled?
Fuck this.
He turned the key in the ignition, but he didn't want to go.
Why are you even here? You told me to stay away from her.
I knew you wouldn't, and I wanted to prepare her. Sarah added, You're welcome, by the way. That's the worst thing I've ever had to do to another woman.
Are you the patron saint of rape victims now?
I'm her doctor. She is my patient. Sarah slammed her fist against her chest.
My patient, not your witness. Your patient could have told me there was a sadist raping women on campus last year. She could have prevented Becky Catarino from being attacked.
The same way you prevented Leslie Truong from disappearing?
That's a low blow. Everything is a low blow,
Sarah said. Everything is awful. That's life, Jeffrey. You can only do what you can do. You can't expect Tommy to bear the weight of responsibility for everything bad that has happened. She's barely taken care of herself. And you can't solve this by beating up her father as some kind of stand-in for the man who really hurt her.
I wasn't.
He stopped short of slamming his fist against the steering wheel.
I wasn't going to hit him.
Sarah let him stew in his own delusion. As annoying as her silence could be, she sometimes used it judiciously. Jeffrey felt the tension start to release from his body. His mind started to clear. This was Sarah's white magic. She made him feel like the world was not going to grind him down into the ground. He would do anything to have these moments last. He looked back at the house again. He hoped like hell that Tommy Humphrey would be able to find that same peace one day. Sarah cleared her throat. Tommy said the attacker swung something at her head. She didn't see it, but she was incapacitated by the blow. Again, Jeffrey thought of the crescent-shaped depression on the X-ray of Rebecca Catarino's skull. He said,
"A hammer."
Tommy's not exaggerating about her pubic hair being bleached. I could still smell it on her the next morning, even after she'd showered. Jeffrey nodded for her to continue, because he desperately needed to talk this out. She said, "I feel like the attacker was watching her. He saw his chance when she was leaving the gym. He had the hammer with him. He had the bleach-soaked rag prepared to clean off any DNA. Which means he planned everything ahead of time, then waited for his moment." Jeffrey had worked out the same scenario with Katerina.
"I think he was watching Becky, too.
She left the library around 5 in the morning. She had a meeting with Sybil at 7. If the attacker knew Becky's schedule, he could have been waiting outside the dorm to follow her. Then he sees she's going for a run, and he decides to make his move."
"So you can assume the assailant is older, more patient. He's able to blend in around town. He wants to be in control. He's methodical, prepared." Jeffrey wanted her to be wrong, because that type of assailant was the hardest to find. He asked,
"Did you smell bleach on Becky?"
"No." Sarah paused, thinking. "What does that mean to you? That 5 months ago with Tommy, the attacker brought a hammer and the rag with bleach. But yesterday, with Becky, he used a hammer and probably wiped her down with something unscented."
"He's altering his M.O., learning how to get better."
Jeffrey couldn't consider the ramifications for the town.
"What about the Gatorade?"
"Blue," Sarah said. "The undigested food blocking Becky's throat had a blue color, consistent with Gatorade."
"So did her vomit."
Jeffrey had thrown away his shirt and pants. He needed to get them out of the trash, in case they were needed as evidence.
"There must have been a drug in the drink."
"Rohypnol? GHB?" Sarah guessed. He wanted her to be immobilized. Either one of those drugs would cause loss of muscle control, drowsiness, memory loss, a sense of euphoria.
"Date rape drugs,"
he said, because he worked in a campus town, and he was very familiar with the substances.
"The attacker told her to keep her eyes open. He wanted her to know what he was doing, but he didn't want her to stop it."
"Drugging her would take away her awareness. Tommy said he waited for her to wake up in the woods. I'm certain she was still slipping in and out of consciousness. What she told you about the actual physical details of the rape, there's more to it than that." Jeffrey shook his head. He wasn't ready to hear the more right now.
"What about the knitting needle he threatened Tommy with? Could that be the tool that was used to paralyze Becky?"
"No," Sarah explained. "The puncture that we saw on Becky's MRI was too small in circumference. He used something else."
"He learned to use something else,"
Jeffrey said.
"You think he has medical knowledge?"
"I think he has the internet," she said. "You're right about him learning, though. The violence from Tommy to Becky feels like experimentation. He told Tommy to pretend she was paralyzed. He made sure Becky didn't have a choice. He wants them to be aware of the rape, but he doesn't want them to be able to fight back. That's his kink. He's had 5 months to work on perfecting it." Jeffrey stared at the empty street ahead of him. Leslie Truong was still missing. They had combed the woods last night, but that was a lot of territory to cover in the dark. She could be lying out there, trapped in a half-alive, half-dead state. He asked Sarah,
"Are there more girls, former patients you're not telling me about?"
"No." Jeffrey didn't have time to feel relieved.
"There has to be a fantasy element.
He strategizes before he acts. He hunts them. He follows them. This man is a predator.
What did you mean when you asked Tommy if she was missing something?
Caterino had a hair clip that was important to her. Apparently, it wasn't in the place where she usually left it. Leslie Truong was missing a headband, but that feels different. Some clothes were missing, too.
She thought her roommates were stealing from her. His phone rang. Jeffrey dreaded looking at the caller ID, but it wasn't his mother again. It was the station. He answered,
"What is it?"
"Leslie Truong," Frank said. "A student found her body in the woods."
Jeffrey felt like a broken piece of metal had embedded itself inside his chest.
"How bad is it?"
"Bad," Frank said. "You need to bring Sarah."
Atlanta. Chapter 13. Will sat at his desk inside GBI headquarters and tried to focus on the words on the paper in front of him. He used a 6-inch metal ruler to anchor each line, but the letters still switched and bounced around like fleas. He had stopped carrying a notebook years ago. He dictated his observations into his phone. Then he printed out the pages. Then he used a comb binder to hold them all together. Will had learned the hard way that he shouldn't trust spell check. Proofreading was the last hurdle. Contractions were particularly problematic. Normally, he could recognize familiar phrases and spot where the problems were. Right now, he wasn't sure he could recognize his own face in the mirror. He sat back in the chair. He rubbed the sleep out of his eyes. His back ached. His brain felt bruised. His knuckles started bleeding every time he flexed his fingers. He had ended up at Faith's last night, sleeping in Jeremy's twin bed on his faded Star Wars sheets. Will's feet had hung off the end of the mattress. He was reminded of being back in the children's home. Which was great, because why not pile onto the misery? There were not enough lunch trays in the world for him to compartmentalize what had happened with Sarah the night before. Will had never put Sarah in any category even remotely close to his ex-wife. But suddenly, Sarah was doing that thing that Angie had done. The thing that had made him feel crazy and angry and frustrated and self-loathing all at the same time. His entire relationship with Angie had been marked by anxiety. She was with him. She was with someone else. She disappeared. She came back. She pushed him to the brink. She jerked him back in line. She had chiseled away at Will since he was 11 years old. There wasn't one moment in their life together where Will had felt safe. And now, he felt like he was teetering on the edge with Sarah. Will had known from the second he'd entered her apartment that he was going to be pissed off when he left. That was why he'd put off seeing her in the first place. From the beginning, nothing had felt right, not even the music Sarah was listening to. Paul Simon. Will didn't know what to do with that. He had thought that he was a pretty good judge of Sarah's moods based on what music she was playing. Dolly Parton meant she was sad. Lizzo got her ready for the gym. Beyonce accompanied her on a run. She listened to NPR Tiny Desk concerts when she was doing paperwork, Adele when she was feeling romantic, and Pink when she was DTF. He figured that Paul Simon meant she was thinking about Jeffrey. Her dead husband's file boxes had been stacked on the dining room table when Will had walked in. The same table where Will and Sarah ate meals. The same table where they had first made love. The sound of Will's key in the door had clearly sent her scrambling to hide Jeffrey's things. Will could tell from the level on the scotch bottle that she'd had more than one drink. Her eyes were bloodshot. She'd looked shattered. He didn't have to guess why. A few years ago, Will had overheard Sarah say something to her sister about Jeffrey Tolliver's beautiful handwriting. She was weirdly fixated on it. Will looked down at his printed notes. The dictation app was a godsend. His handwriting was like a child's. Even his signature was an unreadable chicken scratch. Emma had better penmanship than he did, and she was only allowed to use crayons.
Wilbur?
Amanda opened the door as she knocked. Her lips pursed to bark in order, but she saw what he was wearing and recalibrated.
Were you on your way to the dollar store to buy cigarillos?
Will hadn't wanted to go by his house this morning. He was dressed in what he'd slept in, what he'd worn to Sarah's apartment, a light blue button-down shirt and a pair of jeans. Unusually, Amanda seemed to be waiting for an answer. He said,
Yes.
She scowled but let it go.
We've got an all hands in the briefing room. 15 minutes. Be prepared to speak complete sentences with your mouth.
He watched the door close behind her. He did the math, calculating how long it would take him to drive from the GBI's Pantherville Road headquarters into the city, then back again. A hell of a lot longer than 15 minutes. There was another knock at the door. Will expected it to open because no one waited after a knock. It was more like a one-second warning that someone was about to come in. The door did not open. Will called.
Yes?
Sarah came in. The space instantly felt smaller. She closed the door behind her. She leaned back, her hand still on the knob like she needed to remind herself that there was an escape. These were the top three scenarios that Will had played out in his head last night when he was trying to rehearse a response to seeing Sarah for the first time this morning. 1. In the briefing room, her in the front, him in the back. She looked at him. He looked at her. They both did their jobs. 2. In the morgue, her going over the findings of Alexandra McAllister's autopsy. Him patiently listening in the back. 3. In the hallway, her walking to her office, him with Faith. They ignored each other because they were both professionals. None of that happened. Nor was it going to happen because Sarah started crying.
My love, she said, I'm so sorry.
Will felt a rock lodge inside his throat.
I looked for you, she said. I waited at your house. I drove to Amanda's. I finally saw your car at Faith's. I was so worried, but I didn't. I knew you needed space. Do you still need space?
Will thought about her frantically driving around in the dark, looking for him, finding him, going back home.
Will.
She walked around his desk. She got down on her knees. She gripped one of his hands in both of hers.
I am so sure of you. Of us. It never occurred to me that you needed to hear me say it. I'm sorry.
Will tried to clear his throat. The rock wouldn't budge.
I should have texted you earlier. I should have called you. I should have gone to you.
She pressed her lips to the back of his hand. I ignored the one person I needed the most. Please tell me how to make this right. Will could think of a lot of things, but he didn't know how to ask for any of them without sounding jealous, or worse, pathetic.
Tell me you want to spend the rest of your life with me. Tell me that I am the only man you ever want to be with. Tell me that you love me more than Jeffrey.
She said,
I know I have no right to ask you for this, but please talk to me.
He finally managed to swallow the rock. It turned into battery acid inside his stomach. He told Sarah,
It's okay.
It's not okay.
She sat back on her heels.
I love you. You are my life. But...
He felt the room grow smaller. She said,
I loved Jeffrey. I would still be with him if he hadn't died.
Will looked down at his hand, which she was still holding. His other hand was still bleeding. He rested it on his desk. He had no idea what was going to come out of Sarah's mouth next, but it took every ounce of self-control not to stop her. She said,
But that doesn't make you my second choice.
or a consolation prize, or a stand-in, or anything else that I know you're thinking.
She had no idea what he was thinking.
Baby, I don't have to be with anyone. I could choose to be alone for the rest of my life.
She sat up on her knees so they could face each other.
I choose you, my love. I choose you for as long as you'll have me. I want you. I want to be with you.
She was saying most of the things that he wanted to hear, but Will wasn't sure what to do with them. He was still hurt. He was still bruised from the way she had treated him. He knew the battery acid in his stomach was going to keep festering if he didn't find some way to make it go away. He said,
Angie did that, what you did.
She looked like he'd slapped her.
Tell me.
Tears were already rolling down her face. He wasn't sure he could keep hurting her like this. But he said,
She pushed me.
Sarah bit her bottom lip.
She wanted me to be rough with her, but not.
He hated the lingering, bitter taste of Angie's name in his mouth.
She didn't want me to hit her or... I mean, not that. But that's the only way she would do it with me. Rough. And she wouldn't... You know, she wouldn't finish. I tried, but... Christ.
This was too hard. Will used his thumb to squeeze the blood out of his knuckle. He watched it roll down his finger, drip onto his desk. He looked back at Sarah. She was waiting for him to continue.
It's like...
Guilt weighed on him because this wasn't just Will's private misery. It was Angie's, too. He knew so much about her life. The deep, dark, horrible things that strangers could only guess at. There was a reason she was drawn to violence. Sometimes he thought of himself as her Pandora's box. That was the problem between them. They had known each other's most intimate secrets. He didn't want to make the same mistake with Sarah.
I don't know.
She carefully stroked his hair behind his ear.
I knew the first time I made love to you that she had never let you in.
Will felt embarrassed. There were so many invisible ways that Angie had screwed him up. He was like a constantly reincarnating suicide bomber. But Angie held the detonator every time.
You are inside me,
Sarah told him.
You have my heart. You have every part of me.
Will looked at the printout on his desk. The letters blurred. If something happened to him, all that would be left were reams of typed pages with stupid misspellings that even a third grader would spot. He told her,
I'm sorry.
My love, you have nothing to be sorry for. I was wrong. Everything I did with you yesterday was wrong. I'm so lucky, so grateful to have you.
Sarah gently turned his head back in her direction.
You are smart and funny and handsome and sexy. And I love the way you make me finish every time.
Will's jaw tightened. He hadn't asked for compliments, and he felt stupid that she thought he needed them.
I know we can't be okay right now, but can we be all right?
Her fingers lightly smoothed the tension out of his jaw. There was nothing sexual about her touch. She was reconnecting with him, trying to clear away his doubt.
What can I do to make you sure of me?
Will did not have an answer. She was right. He was not okay. The only thing that would get him to all right was to stop talking. He pulled Sarah into his lap. Her arms wrapped around his shoulders. She laid her head on his chest. He could tell she was listening to his heartbeat. He breathed deeply, trying to slow the pace. He felt confused and whiplashed. He yearned for that safety that only Sarah had ever given him. Two knocks at the door introduced Faith. She saw Sarah in Will's lap and said,
Oh, shit.
Will tensed, but Sarah simply raised her head. She asked Faith,
Is the meeting about to start?
Yep. Yep, yep, yep.
Faith clasped her hands together.
Yes, siree.
The heel of her shoe got caught in the door as she rushed to close it. Sarah told Will, I brought you a suit from home. When you didn't show up at your house this morning, I figured you'd need a change of clothes. He got a petty kind of solace at the thought of Sarah waiting for him to come home. She looked at his bleeding hand. I want to clean that before you leave. He grunted. I should get my notes for the meeting. She stood up and adjusted her dress, which was light and flowy in all the right places. Will realized that she was not wearing her usual work uniform of light-colored slacks and a dark blue GBI shirt. Her long, curly hair was hanging down around her shoulders instead of clipped up out of the way. She was wearing heels. Her eyeliner was darker than usual. She had even put on lipstick. If Will had noticed these things when Sarah had first walked into his office, maybe he wouldn't have had to tell her that Angie's idea of a good time was antagonizing him into fucking the shit out of her. I'll see you there. Sarah stroked his face one more time before leaving. Will stared at the back of the door long enough that the blood on his desk congealed. He gathered his notes. Out of habit, he reached for his jacket off the back of his chair. He tried to recenter his thoughts on the case. Lena Adams, Gerald, Becky, and Heath Caterina. He was going to have to talk about them, in front of other people. People who knew him. Some of whom knew about his reading issue. Amanda never asked Will to lead briefings. She usually let Faith take the lead because Faith loved taking the lead. He didn't know if Amanda was punishing him for not dressing professionally, or if she was calling on him the way his teachers used to call on him because they thought they were helping Will come out of his shell, when in fact what they were doing was exposing him to his worst nightmare. He looked for Faith in the hall, then in her office. He found her in the kitchen getting a cup of coffee. He said,
Sorry about that.
About what?
Which was how they were going to leave it. Will followed Faith into the squad room. She sat at one of the desks in the front row. Will felt like he needed to recalibrate his opinion of what they could talk about. Not that they had talked about anything last night. When he'd knocked on Faith's door, she hadn't asked him what the hell he was doing there. She had fed him a gallon of ice cream and beat his ass up and down Vice City until midnight.
Sup?
Charlie Reed took a seat beside Faith. Rashid was next. He came in carrying two cups of coffee that apparently were not meant to be shared. Gary Quintana, Sarah's assistant, joined them on the front row, all lined up like teacher's pets. Will leaned his back against the wall. He was not a teacher's pet.
Morning, bud.
Nick Shelton clapped Will on the shoulder as he passed by, doing that weird grip-pat thing again. His jeans were so tight that Will imagined he had to lie down on the floor to tug them on. Nick sat a few chairs away from Charlie. He opened up his tooled leather briefcase that looked like it had been stolen from Patsy Cline. Hey. Sarah winked at him as she entered the room. Will watched her walk to the front row. She had pinned up her hair. He studied the graceful curve of her neck as she sat beside Faith. Sarah gave her a one-armed hug that Faith seemed happy to return, a woman's version of a fist bump to smooth things over. Will guessed he should sit down, if only to avoid Amanda's further ire. He took the desk in the row behind Sarah, off to the side so he could see her profile. She was reading her notes. Her fingers absently twirled her hair. He made himself look at something other than Sarah. The briefing room was a typical government rectangle with frayed carpet and a drop ceiling that had dropped too many times. The floor-to-ceiling windows overlooked the parking lot. Water stains spotted the tiles. The desks were mostly squeaky or broken, or both. The overhead projector was a relic that Amanda would not let go of. The television was the tube kind, with a portable VCR the size of a wooden pallet. The only indication that they were living in the 21st century came from the four smart boards at the front of the room. The interactive displays could be hooked up to computers, tablets, even phones. Will recognized Faith's handiwork. She had projected Gerald Catarino's murder closet across the four panels. Every photograph, printout, police report, and notation that had been recorded on her phone was blown up onto the boards. He still had no idea how Faith had figured out that Heath Catarino was Becky's child. The saliva on the back of Daryl Nesbitt's prison envelope had proven Faith's hypothesis. Gerald had shown them the DNA test results from the strip mall lab that specialized in forcing men to pay child support. All of the genetic markers excluded Daryl Nesbitt from paternity. He was not Heath's father, which meant he had not raped Becky Catarino. No wonder the girl's father had slept with a gun by his bed for the past 5 years. Will heard the click of Amanda's cloven hooves in the hallway. She was texting on her phone, even as she took her place at the podium. Eventually, she looked up. No preamble. She jumped right in.
We have several unknowns, but this is where we're at. As Dr. Linton will outline, there are compelling circumstantial connections between the two Grant County victims and the murder of Alexandra McAllister. That's it. For the purposes of our discussion, we treat the Catarino, Truong, and McAllister cases as most likely perpetrated by the same unknown suspect. As to the other victims from the newspaper articles, we have nothing but supposition. For those of you keeping score, it takes three victims to make a serial killer. For those of you who cannot count, we have two dead women. Rebecca Catarino is most certainly alive. Will, you're first. Then Dr. Linton, then Faith. Then I need Nick and Rashid to update me on the Vasquez murder at the prison.
Will felt a nauseating stir deep within his bowels. He would have loosened his tie if he had been wearing one, which was clearly Amanda's point. He said,
"We interviewed."
"Podium?"
"Fuck."
Will felt roughly 10 years old as he walked to the front of the class. He stacked his papers on the podium. He stared down at the jumble of words. Stress exacerbated his issue. All he could make out were numbers. Fortunately, yesterday had been the kind of exhausting day that had imprinted itself into every fold of his brain. He said,
"At 11:45 yesterday morning, Faith and I interviewed Lena Adams at her home in Macon, Georgia. She was notably belligerent."
Someone snorted. He assumed Faith. He said,
"Faith managed to extract two useful pieces of information from Adams. One, Daryl Nesbitt's lawsuit was funded by a benefactor. Later investigation revealed that benefactor was Gerald Catarino. Two, Bonita Truong, who was the mother of Leslie, relayed during a phone call with Gerald Catarino that a week prior to her daughter's disappearance, she reported being upset about a stolen personal item. Again, Gerald Catarino was able to supply us with the information that the item was a headband. When Faith pushed him, he equivocated, stating there might have been other stolen items such as clothing. But the headband could be significant. According to Catarino's notes on the conversations he had with parents and other survivors, the women from the articles were also missing hair items, like a comb or a brush or a clip. You can see the list on the board."
"If I may?" Sarah had her hand raised. He couldn't tell if she was trying to bail him out, but he welcomed the interruption. "According to what I read in the Grant County files last night, both Catarino and Truong kept the missing or stolen hair accessories in a particular location. Becky always wore her hair clip on her bedside table. Leslie kept a pink headband in a basket with the cleanser she used to wash her face every night. I would normally say take that with a grain of salt because it's all according to Lena's notebooks, but..." "Hold on." Faith had done a double take.
"Say that again."
Sarah opened one of her file folders. She held up two photographs. Each one showed a different girl with her hair pulled back in a different way. These photographs show the hair accessories. Faith asked,
"You've got Lena's notebooks."
They were only photocopies in the boxes, but yes.
Ha!
Faith pumped her fist in the air.
Eat my crusty shorts, you pregnant reptile.
Dr. Linton, can you share those notes, please? Amanda added. You might as well take over. Will, that's all. Thank you for the usual thorough job.
Sarah squeezed his hand as she took his position behind the podium. I want to start with Thomasina Humphrey. Faith flipped to a new page in her notebook. Will sat down beside her. He wiped the sweat off the back of his neck. His knuckle was bleeding again. Sarah began. Tommy was 21 years old when she was attacked. She grew up in the community. She was my patient at the clinic from the age of 14, so I knew her fairly well. She was a virgin prior to the assault, which isn't unusual. Approximately 6.5% of all women report their first sexual experience as rape. The average victim is 15 years old. Sarah held up a photograph of Thomasina Humphrey, who was standing in front of what looked like a science fair display. I can't definitively tell you that Tommy